to order the Business, Labor, and Consumer Affairs Committee. And first on the agenda is to hold a public hearing on House Bill 2077. And Janet, can you give us a summary on the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you should have the dash two amendments that were in your packet. They replaced the original bill. This is a bill that would require the Department of Transportation to adjust public improvement contracts at the contractor's request if the contractor demonstrates that the market price of steel material is 20% or more above the price of the material when the contract was entered into. Mr. Chair, there's people here to explain the bill, so I think I will stop there.
Thank you, Janet. Could we have Jessica and John Jackley and Tim Hendricks, please? Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jessica Harris-Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors, and we appreciate the committee's willingness to hear this bill and consider the dash two amendments and actually the issue in and of itself. This is an issue that has really affected Oregon construction contractors, specifically those working on ODOT projects. In late 2003, early 2004, and throughout 2004, the price of steel, out of the knowledge and control in a worldwide event, steel prices went through the roof, and contractors found themselves in a position of being held to a contract without the ability to get relief for the prices of steel and the steel increases. We're here today to ask for your help in relieving those contractors of some of the burden of that so that they continue to be good players and productive players in the Oregon market. Here with me today is Tim Hendricks with Wildish Construction to talk more about the issue and his perspective as a contractor in Oregon.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Tim Hendricks. I'm the manager for Wildish's Highway, Bridge, and Airport Division, stationed in Eugene. I'm a registered PE in the state of Oregon. I'm also on the board of directors of AGC, Columbia Chapter. And I'm here on behalf of my fellow members to urge you to adopt the amendments to House Bill 2077. Wildish is a homegrown Oregon business based in Eugene. We've been there for 70 years. We build multi-story office buildings. I can't see my own writing.
Want me to hold the paper out here for you?
I might have to do that. Shopping centers, industrial plants and parks, warehouses, hydroelectric facilities, treatment plants, bridges, schools, hospitals, medical clinics, streets, highways, and runways, airport runways. So today I'm here to share with you about the steel crisis that's paralyzed all of Oregon's highway construction industry and why House Bill 2077 is so important to help repair the damage that this crisis has caused. In the waning months of 2003 and then into 2004, the price of steel in this state, in the nation, and worldwide began to rise at an uncontrollable, unanticipated, and unprecedented rate. The rise in these prices was so volatile that suppliers to the contractors were not able to honor bid quotes that they gave us that we used going in with our prices to owners. These suppliers were experiencing additional surcharges from the mills that were supplying them material, and they were passing those on to the contractors. The cause of this crisis can be attributed to many sources. Number one, China and other developing countries began to buy scrap steel at very aggressive rates, which caused the price of scrap steel to increase sharply. Estimates indicate that at one point China was consuming as much as one-third of the world's supply of steel. Number two, the prices of coke, which is a material used in the production of steel, rose sharply when there was a fire at a West Virginia coal mine that you may have read about, and that caused a severe shortage of coke material. Number three, many steel producers in the United States began to consolidate during the same time period. And number four, world events that drove up the demand of structural steel occurred for military reasons around the globe. all of these events that combined at one time and completely out of control of the construction industry here in Oregon, certainly, resulted in a sharp increase in steel prices unlike anything I've seen in my 29 years at Wilish. Now, the contractors in Oregon tried to respond to this crisis by purchasing steel in advance as soon as we recognized that the market was fluctuating and spiraling upward. However, in the Northwest, the mills began putting their fabricators, which is the people we buy steel products from, on allotments because the steel was not only increasing in price, but there was a shortage of it. So we couldn't pre-buy the steel and have it available for jobs to protect, for our projects to protect the prices that we had. Instead, we as contractors were forced to absorb the price increases that were impossible to predict and far exceeded the amounts that we put into our contracts. Now, AGC and its contractors have been working with ODOT for over a year now, actually about 16 months, to try and respond to this crisis. We've been addressing the issue two ways. First, we were trying to establish a steel escalation clause on new contracts that are coming up, because we don't know how much this stuff's going to move in the future. And this would be an escalator-de-escalator clause, such that if steel prices went down, we'd also be willing to give that money back, depending on what we paid for the steel. But the second thing we were doing was to try and find a way to have contractors recover this unprecedented increase in steel costs on contracts we had under contract already. Today, if a person signed an ODOT contract, if a contractor did, you can find in there oil and fuel escalation, de-escalation clauses. Those exist. Those have been negotiated over time. Many of them, let's see, oil's been in place for about 20 years and fuel for 15 or 20 years. This clause was developed by contractors and ODOT to protect all the parties against the up and downs in oil and fuel prices. We're working on this similar provision for steel, and we believe that we're close to agreement with ODOT on how to move forward on contracts. But the current contracts present a situation that's not so easily resolved. ODOT's specifications do not allow relief to contractors for extraordinary events such as this unless it already specifically says so in the contract. ODOT and AGC contractors, attorneys, have spent hours looking for ways to find relief under the current contract language, and the conclusion has been that there is no legal way for ODOT to provide payment on these claims on past projects. The amendments to House Bill 2077 will provide ODOT with the ability to accept and pay these claims. Contractors, by our very nature, are around to accept risks. That's what we do. And every time we bid a hard money contract, there's a chance that the prices of commodities may adjust. In this case, however, the prices didn't just adjust. They rose sharply, and even experts in the steel industry were unable to predict how or when these might level off. This left contractors and suppliers in a real bind, and for small contractors in particular, the rising price of steel created financial hardship that frankly has caused one of the largest suppliers that we obtained our steel from to go out of business, Graham Steel. You've probably heard of them. They closed their doors because of the commitments that they had to provide steel at X price. Prices went through the roof from the mills, so they couldn't provide, or they'd just go out of business. And that's what they did. They filed for bankruptcy, and that left many of the contractors holding the bag for those price increases. When someone like Graham Steel closes, what that does is that affects the entire market. And there aren't a lot of people that supply steel in this market. And we're concerned about what that's going to do for pricing in the future. So we need to protect the people that are long-standing, able to supply steel, and the contractors that buy from them. This bill will significantly heal the financial wounds on these past projects for Oregon contractors and subsequently their suppliers who found themselves caught in this crisis with no way but spending their own company's equity to recover the costs, or in the case of Graham Steel, just go out of business. So we urge your support, and I thank you.
Thank you, Tim. John, did you have testimony this morning, too?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Jackley. I'm with the Highway Division at the Department of Transportation. The previous speakers did an excellent job of describing the steel crisis that we face, the impact on the industry, and it's also important to keep in mind that it's not just about the contractors themselves, but it's about the workforce. The people who work in highway construction are highly skilled. These are Oregon family wage jobs. They produce sustainable careers, and along with the industry, we're concerned about the ripple effect of a steel crisis on the workforce as well. We have worked cooperatively with AGC and the contracting community on specifications for our contracts that would look ahead, and those talks are going very, very well, and we hope to finalize it in the next couple of months. The issue, though, is for contracts that were awarded prior to the price increase, we don't have any legal means of going back and, in essence, opening up those contracts and helping, excuse me, these Oregon businesses deal with the severe effect of the steel crisis. We've looked at the Dash 2 amendments. We agree that the intent is good. We're in the process of trying to work out some of the details. We just want to double check that the language actually does allow us to go back into the contracts. And then there's the issue of how much risk the department, hence the taxpayers, would assume, how much risk the contractors would assume. I think we're really, really close, if not there. We feel that the intent of these amendments is solid. It will allow us to compensate contractors for these cost increases for all projects awarded after April 1st, 2003. Doing this isn't a contractual obligation, but I think we have a greater obligation both to the business community and to the workers in the state. We need these same workers who are working on current projects to be able to stay on the job, be able to stay in their careers as we move forward into large construction programs such as those sponsored by the Oregon Transportation Investment Act and others. We feel that this bill is needed to allow us to be able to reimburse contractors for these unanticipated increases, and we look forward to hopefully finishing up the details in the next couple of days. Thank you.
Thank you, John. And so the final tweaking will be back next week to us because time is of the essence to
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Jessica Adamson, we believe we've reached an agreement out in the hall this morning, so it's just a matter of getting the language right, and we should be able to have that back hopefully Monday, Tuesday, and look forward to having it here in front of you on Wednesday.
Okay, thank you. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you very much for your testimony this morning. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2077 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3271 and 3281 jointly. And so, Janet, can you give us a summary of those bills?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 3271 would eliminate the exemption in current law for qualified rehabilitation facilities that currently exempts them from requirements that public contracts be competitively bid. And it also eliminates their exemption from competitive public procurement laws. It would require a contracting agency to conduct a public hearing before the agency awards a public contract to a qualified rehabilitation facility. And, Mr. Chair, in your packet was about a four-page document that is the statutes that cover the products of the Disabled Individuals Law. This is a law that has dated in Oregon back to 1977. It does require state and local agencies to procure goods and services from qualified rehabilitation facilities and abbreviated QRFs if the product or service meets agency requirements and the product or service is included on a procurement list that's maintained by the Department of Administrative Services. The law also exempts public improvement contracts made with QRFs from competitive bidding requirements. So those statutes are all listed, and House Bill 3271 does repeal two statutes, and those are italicized, not in the bill, but in the list of statutes, or the four-page compilation of the statutes. And then House Bill 3281, affecting the same statutes and the same program, would exempt school districts, education service districts, and community college districts from the requirement to procure products or services from qualified rehabilitation facilities. So it would leave local governments and the state agencies in the program, but exempt those school entities. So, Mr. Chair, that's what I have. There's a number of items already at your desk, and a number of people signed up.
Thank you, Janet. Committee, it is my intention to, we have a lot of people signed up that would like to testify on these bills, and it's my intention that we will adjourn by 11:30 this morning, and so we are going to bring members, our people testifying up in panels and groups, and there may be some time limitations placed after the initial proponents and opponents state their give us their testimony. And for those that are here to testify again, I'll bring you up in groups, and that we will have a limited time this morning. We're going to adjourn by 11:30, and if someone has already made your point, please keep your testimony brief then, so that someone that's wanting to testify behind you can have that opportunity. And if you're submitting written testimony, please summarize that testimony, and as opposed to reading it word for word. And I thank you. And we will, with that, I'd like to call forward J.L. Wilson and Ed Edwards. First. And on deck will be Mary Bodkins and Bob Wagner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm J.L. Wilson, representing the National Federation of Independent Business. I have 12,000 employers in the state of Oregon.
Excuse me just a minute, J.L. And then people giving testimony, remember, we have a joint hearing going on both bills, so give your testimony for both the bills at the same time.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. For the record, J.L. Wilson, representing NFIB Oregon, representing 12,000 small employers in the state of Oregon. They say politics makes strange bedfellows, and you're witnessing that today. I'm happy to be here with my friend Ed Edwards. We're both sponsors of House Bill 3281. I would note for the record that 3271 is also very consistent with NFIB's philosophy of a full competitive bid process for contracts at all levels of government. But I will speak today to 3281 because our name is on that bill. 3281 restores a fair competitive bidding process for private businesses interested in securing public contracts, and this bill only applies to school districts, ESDs, and community colleges. So it does not apply to all levels of government, just at the level of public education. At issue in House Bill 3281 is the fundamental issue of set-aside contracts for qualified rehab facilities. Under current law, if a QRF wants to offer a product or service to any government entity, that government entity is legally required to purchase from the QRFs. You would then understand why business would be why this would give business groups pause, because in fact businesses are X'd out of the process. If in fact you're a business that offers a product or service to a government entity and a QRF decides it wants to offer that same product or services, you are precluded from bidding or retaining your job with that local government or government entity. At the macro level, we are concerned about this law for two reasons. First, small businesses that would ordinarily qualify as a low bidder for a public contract are displaced. And I think that that comes at the expense of both the business and the taxpayer. Second, QRFs are able to utilize revenue from set-aside contracts to help subsidize private sector contracts, and we think that that's also harmful to small business. But to get down to the nitty-gritty and the specific concerns of the current products of disabled law and why we are in the position that we're in, I want to outline a few specific items for you. First, again, to talk about the point of small businesses that would otherwise secure a public contract through being a low bidder are actually shut out of the process. I have an attachment as part of my testimony, a story from the Albany Democrat Herald subsequent to the 2003 session, where there was a company, Chorak Mowing, provided years of grounds maintenance to the Lebanon School District, and the QRF decided that they wanted to get involved in that contract, and they were, and the school district was legally required to go with the QRF. Chorak Mowing provided that service at $25,000 per year. The QRF provided it at $37,000 per year, a difference of $12,000. The private sector company, Chorak in this case, lost its bid, and it came at greater expense to taxpayers. That's a story that happens more than once, and it is of concern to us as a business organization and as an organization that cares about use of taxpayer money. Second, we are concerned about the list of goods and services offered by QRFs. It's extensive, and it's continually growing. You'll hear testimony from the business side anyway, from folks who do landscaping, mail service, janitorial, security service, even remanufactured toner cartridges. And this is in addition to voc rehab, vocational services, clerical services, messenger services, laundry, and records management. And I have attached for you a more comprehensive list in my testimony that was included with the state's chief procurement officer and a response to Representative Dingfelder. You see a more comprehensive list of goods and services that are offered by QRFs. You can understand why, again, this would give business groups pause, because you're seeing an encroachment on what's typically private sector activity, goods and services that are offered by QRFs, and again, since they are exempted from the competitive bid process, they have an automatic market share that small business would otherwise be able to compete for. And again, that gives us quite a bit of heartburn. The third point I'd like to make is that the private sector community to this point has had little to no say, at least from our perspective, on what goods or services can be offered by a QRF, what's on the so-called procurement list. Now, to illustrate our concerns, I've attached the bylaws for what is the QRF Advisory Council. And the bylaws I've attached are from the years, I believe, 1994 to 2001. So I want to be very honest and say these are not the current bylaws. But understand that the lion's share of goods and services that are put on the procurement list were put in this period of time. And you see that the QRF Council it serves to advise the director of DAS to facilitate implementation of the products of disabled law. And among the things they do is make recommendations based on placing goods or services on the procurement list. And subsequently, you see down on council membership that the council membership includes the stakeholders, which are public agency, qualified rehab facilities, the Oregon Rehab Association, and others as necessary. There was no private sector representation. There's no union representation. In other words, where is business ever able to insert itself in the process of being able to have some say on what goods and services are put on the procurement list? At some point, business has got to have some level of oversight. There's got to be some level of agreement from the private sector as to what can be offered on the procurement list, because right now we have no say, and we see that the list continually gets bigger, and you see that it encroaches on activity typically performed by the private sector. The next point I'd like to make, affected businesses at this point really have limited to no recourse. If you're a business today and you provide landscaping service to a school district and they decide that a QRF is going to provide that service, do you get notification as an affected business that you could be out of a contract? You do not get that notification today. In fact, stakeholders who have public contracts that could be offered by a QRF, there is no notification, at least none that I know of. And in addition, a 60-day window of appeal a 60-day window of protest has now been whittled down to 14 days. So not only do you not get notification that your contract with a public entity is in jeopardy, you have 14 days to appeal what you don't even know is happening. And at some point, there has got to be a level of recourse of recourse for a business who has this happen to them, because right now it's a completely untenable situation. Next, I want to get to what is probably the heart of the matter, and that is what it means to be disabled. I think what constitutes the definition of a disability under the Oregon Products of Disabled Law is probably the heart of this issue. you know, QRFs are in the business of providing employment opportunities for those who are severely disabled, and we strongly believe that there's a place in law for that. There just is, and we have no problem with that. But we also believe that what constitutes a disability for the purposes of providing a QRF its workforce today is growing much broader in scope than what it was ever meant to be. Now, a couple points I want to make. One is an attachment I have in my testimony that is from St. Vincent de Paul, and admittedly it's a few years old. But look at the list of qualifying conditions that qualify as severely disabled. You have everything from allergic conditions, the carpal tunnel, and you see the list, to drugs and alcohol recovery, eating disorders, heart conditions, ulcers, varicose veins. I mean, our point is, at some point, you've got to get your hands around a definition of what it means to be disabled for the purposes of application of this law. And I just want, from our point of view, we want certainty. Certainty is what we're looking at, because there seems to be a moving target as to what constitutes disabled. And, you know, to us, in searching for a level playing field, we are looking for a concrete definition that we can all agree to, and it's something that you can apply to this law. You know, in this morning's Oregonian, you probably read the value of an exemption, which is a story on exactly what we're talking about today. And former representative and attorney general Dave Frohnmayer said that the idea was to help people who are mentally disabled in wheelchairs or some kind of paralysis or amputation or disability of limbs who lack mental acuity. That's a far cry from what you see in the advertisement that I've included in my testimony today. And what I'm suggesting to you is there's got to be a process where you can draw some certainty around what it means to be disabled, where both you and I can explain what it means and explain to our membership what it means. I've also included in my testimony an article called Private Insecurity. This is a company that actually went bankrupt after it lost a contract to provide security services to the Eugene Airport. It lost it lost its contract to Goodwill. And my point being, this is just subsequent to 9/11, where we were technically at war. It would tend to call into question the definition of disability or severely disabled when you are in fact contracting with these folks for security services at an airport when we were at war. And so, you know, at some point, the definition of what it means to be disabled, we have to arrive at a definition that we can agree on and that makes sense. Because right now, I would propose to you that it does not make sense and is very disadvantageous for private companies. And finally, it's kind of a touchy-feely issue, I admit, but, you know, from a business point of view, we just object to the notion that the jobs and employment opportunities that we provide are somehow less valuable than the jobs and employment opportunities that are provided by QRFs. Because that's essentially what you're saying when you displace a private employer for a QRF, a private employer who's been doing a good job on a particular project for years on end, and then they're displaced by a QRF that wants a contract. I have with me, because it's been said that this is, you know, this bill is at the behest of a single employer, I have with me several pieces from different employers, and I'm just going to touch over them briefly. Morris Carpet Cleaning, which did janitorial for the Chemeketa Community College campus, which lost their contract that they'd had for years to a QRF. Overall, which provides uniform services, lost their contract to the Salem Fire Department after having it for a significant period of time. LCR, which does laser cartridge remanufacturing, which lost 62% of their public sector business in the last 3 years to QRFs. I have letters here from Oregon Stamp Impressions, Metropolitan Presort, Clayton Ward, which does recycling. And then you'll hear from various other businesses today. This is a far-reaching issue. There's no question about it. And it's an issue that's not going to go away. And if it's not addressed this time, I submit to you that we're going to be back 2 years from now. The only difference is the list of affected businesses is just going to be bigger. As more businesses are impacted through loss of contracts, through the application of the Oregon Products of Disabled Law. You know, only you have the ability to bring the sides together. Only you have the ability to make decisions. And I would hope that our testimony, we present enough of a case to you today to warrant that discussion. And that's the extent of my testimony, and I'm happy to yield the questions or leave it up to Ed.
Thank you, Joelle. Why don't we take Ed's testimony and then we'll open some questions.
Thank you, Chair Brown and members of the House Committee, House Business, Labor, and Consumers Committee. My name is Ed Edwards. I'm the Director of the of Government Relations for the Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA is an independent Oregon labor union that represents 20,000 educational staff working in Oregon's K-12 schools, education service districts, community colleges, Head Start agencies, libraries, and parks and recreation districts. We are speaking today in favor of House Bill 3281. We also support 3271 as well. But we are at 3281. It was at the request of the Oregon School Employees Association, along with our partner, the National Federation of Independent Businesses. I agree with everything that my friend here stated in his testimony. This is not just simply a labor issue, and it is not simply a small business issue either. It's an issue that is impacting across economic boundaries and both private and public sector workers. The Products of Disabled Individual Law, which 3281 amends, was passed in 1977. That was about 28 years ago. And it passed with universal support by the legislature in session at that time. Its original intent and scope was to provide employment opportunities for the severely handicapped and disabled in a sheltered workshop or activity center. Today, there is a growing number of people and organizations that no longer support what is called the PDIL. OSEA is one of those organizations. We believe that the PDIL, as it is applied and interpreted today, is far removed from its original intent and scope. What was once a good policy, good public policy, and an acceptable law in 1977 has become a nightmare for some working people and small businesses in Oregon. I'd like to take the committee sort of back to 1977 for a minute, because I think it's important that we view what's happening today by remembering what was going on in 1977. The movement to really bring the disabled into the workforce was beginning to gather steam and beginning to make movement throughout the country. Discrimination against disabled was starting to become something that society viewed as wrong. And in 1977, Oregon was on the leading edge to say, you know, we've got to recognize and provide employment opportunities for the disabled. We want the disabled to be in the workforce. And in 1977, they passed an extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary piece of legislation called the Products of Disabled Individuals Law. It's extraordinary because it does things that exempt a certain population of Oregonians from certain laws. It created qualified rehabilitation facilities. It established set-aside contracts to be awarded to QRFs for products and services that were deemed suitable for the severely handicapped and disabled to perform and deliver in a sheltered workshop activity center. The law also required state and local governments to award such contracts for these products and services two qualified rehabilitation facilities without competitive bidding. Now, I'm quite sure there was strong sentiment about that. Competitive bidding process and the public contracting law in Oregon is something that is debated every session. And having a non-competitive bidding process to award a public contract was pretty radical. Instead of competitive bidding, the law set up a method for determining price. And that is done today by the Department of Administrative Services. So it's not, so the employer, or the public employer in this case, has really no control over the price that's going to be charged for this contract for a product or service. And it also requires 75% of the direct labor necessary to deliver a product or service from a very specific population group. And that group is the severely handicapped and disabled. All of this was done for a very specific targeted population. It was not designed to be all-encompassing for all kinds of disabilities. It was designed, and the set-aside contracts established, for a very specific population, severely handicapped, the work to be performed in a sheltered workshop or activity center. That population group today, from estimates that I've seen in Oregon, would qualify 6,000 to 8,000 Oregonians to work in a QRF performing the work of a set-aside contract in a sheltered workshop or activity center. As I stated earlier, the PDL has evolved, though, in the past 28 years. The set-aside contracts need not provide employment opportunity for just the severely handicapped and disabled. Nor does the product or service contracted for need to be performed in a sheltered workshop or activity center, nor is the requirement for the 75% direct labor by disabled applied to a specific contract awarded to a QRF. Today, through administrative interpretations, changes in the PDIL, and opinions from the Attorney General's office, the population group, quote, disabled, the QRS can employ to perform set-aside contracts is today estimated to be between 200 and 300,000 Oregonians. A very big difference in numbers. Today, every work site can be declared a sheltered workshop environment. Today, QRS can gain a set-aside contract and have less than 75% disabled employees performing the work. Two parts of the original bill have not been altered. Set-aside contracts are still mandated to the state and to local governments. And QRFs, though, are still required to provide the product or service contracted to be delivered. And there is no better example in support of our bill, 3281, than PHC, Portland Rehabilitation Centers, using the PDIL to take over the custodial services in the Portland Public Schools. In July of 2002, 318 Portland school custodians were displaced from their jobs to be replaced by disabled PHC employees. In the past few weeks, I've had the opportunity to talk to many of those displaced custodians and hear their stories. And I can tell you that their stories are heartbreaking. Some of these stories were put in writing, which I have included and passed to the committee administrator. There are a few displaced school custodians here today who have come to Salem to tell their story to this committee. OSCA believes that what happened to the Portland school custodians were never, ever envisioned by those who supported the creation of the set-aside contracts and voted yes in 1977 to establish the products of disabled law. These workers lost their jobs, wages, benefits, health insurance, and suffered through hard times, and many of them suffer still today. But the most disturbing part of this event, as we studied what happened during that time, is that the Portland Rehabilitation Center probably should never have been allowed to take the contract, or at a minimum, keep the contract that they had with the Portland Public Schools in providing custodial services. PHC was unable to deliver that service as contracted and be in compliance with the products of disabled individual law. From the very beginning of the contract, PHC had to hire 200 non-disabled workers in order to provide the service it had contracted for. After the school year was over, these 200 employees, workers, were fired because the Portland Rehabilitation Center was out of compliance, and DAS finally sent them a letter saying they had to get into compliance. So we had 318 workers, career custodians, displaced by this law. And then the Portland Rehabilitation Center impacted 200 more workers in order for them to continue to keep this contract. But from OSCA's standpoint, it is beyond belief that the Portland Public School administrators were unaware of the fact that PHC was out of compliance. It is beyond the belief that the Department of Administrative Services was unaware of this fact when it occurred. And it was an act of dishonesty on the part of PHC, knowing it was out of compliance with the 75% direct labor law, and not surrender the contract they had because they were unable to provide the service under the products of disabled individual law. All of this is to show that this program is out of control, that the law is far removed from its original intent. OSCA supports 3281, 3271, because we believe it's in the best interest of our local schools, community colleges, education service districts, and the employees working for these educational institutions to be exempt from this evolved 2005 Products of Disabled Individuals Law. OSCA urges the committee to take a hard look at this and support 3281 and prevent what happened to the Portland Public School custodians and eight of our members in the Rainier School District who suffered the same fate from happening again. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions? Representative Schaffer.
Thank you. This is a very contentious and emotional issue for all of us, I'm sure. 2 years ago, it was real easy to defend QRF and statute, and I still defend QRF and statute, and I will continue to do so. But clearly, everybody isn't satisfied with how this is all panning out. So my questions are many, and we all don't have to answer them today, but if you want to get back to me, I'd appreciate it. My question is, what for everybody too, and not just you two guys. I would like to hear today what the opposing sides are willing to do to bring some amendment, some change, to try and solve some of these issues. I want to hear from private employers what they're willing to do to set aside slots in the workforce to bring the disabled in, to provide them with chance to work and have dignity and provide for themselves. And the definition, according to this definition that I see here, I believe you could have the majority of the population qualify under these. And I'm an insomniac and I can prove it, but I wanted to put that out there. I've said this time and again, I will continue to defend the QRF being in statute, but I do have a problem. I have a big problem with the government, whether it be state, federal, state, local, school district, special districts, having savings, what are called savings, on the backs of any worker. whether they qualify for QRF, whether it's union not getting a contract, anything that bothers me. And I especially have a problem with government saving money on the backs of disabled workers who have displaced workers that before that had family wage jobs with benefits. That's a real problem for me. Now, there's a lot there, Mr. Chair. I promise you I wouldn't ask any questions today because we have a lot going on, but I will.
Folks can just get back to me as they wish or talk about that today.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Esquel.
Yes, my question is this, and I will ask the opposing side here on this. When you get a bid on these, it appeared with this article that you sent in, it was a 50% more bid. Is that correct? It was 50% more than the lowest bid? This thing that happened in Lebanon, the school district that was turned in? Or was that part of your testimony?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Esquivel. As it was in my submission here, yes, that the private sector bidder, which was Chorak Mowing, submitted a $25,000 bid, and that the full year of service from the QRF was in fact $37,000.
$37,000 if you prorated over a whole year, correct?
Correct.
Now my question is: is it required in the statutes that if you come in and it's a $100,000 bid, if QRF comes in and they bid $200,000, do you have to accept the $200,000 bid?
Representative Chair Brown and Representative Esquivel, yes, and that gets to the heart of our issue, at least from a taxpayer concern. And one of our concerns is that if a private entity is able to do it for less, and you'll hear from other businesses who got involved in this issue because they were the low bidder, but they were precluded from ever bidding because there was a QRF involved. And so the answer to your question is yes, you're absolutely precluded from bidding, even if the bid from the QRF is significantly higher.
Representative Gittins.
Just one question related to what Representative Schaffler said and what Representative Esquivel said. So you're really not saving on the backs by taxpayers by hiring QRFs. You may be, in fact, costing taxpayers more money.
Thank you, Representative Brown and Representative Gittins. It really cuts both ways. There are instances where it goes exactly both ways.
And so there are situations where the QRFs are less expensive than let's use the janitors.
Mm-hmm.
Are the QRFs less expensive in that situation than the janitors that lost their jobs?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Kitts, the answer to that question is that the QRFs are less expensive. And we are talking from reading just newspaper reports on that have been covering this particular event. Even though the schools are not being kept up and all this other stuff, the comment from the Portland schools is, well, we saved $5 million.
Okay. I have several questions. I'm going to take all my questions and submit them in writing. I don't know what the chair's intention on the bill is today, but I'm just going to submit them in writing to both sides and ask for answers from both sides.
Any other questions? Don't see any. Thank you for your testimony. I'm going to change a little from the order we have here. There, we have an individual that's came quite a ways to testify and has to leave in a few minutes. So I have Michael Carter, please.
Sure, you got a question on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representatives, thank you very much for allowing me to jump up there.
Okay.
So I can get back to school. My name's Michael Carter. I'm with the Rainier School District. I'm the superintendent, and when I took over the job last year, our district had contracted out. It's always difficult to contract out, but unfortunately, as you know, the funding has been difficult for everyone. And the cutting of every school district, you look at the front line, teachers are the front line as we see it. But custodians, bus drivers, everyone else is part of that team. The first person they see is a bus driver. First person they see, and the students do not recognize who's on contract, who's not. They see people as working for the school. What's happened in Rainier is that we've been able to save over 35% of our budget for custodials by contracting out. We were very concerned. What kind of service we're going to get. Our community showed up. We had QFC come out. QFC was not even an issue for us. Basically, we were looking for the best dollar we could get. we are, we understand it's really difficult to build a contract on employers' backs. We hate the same thing. We're just looking at trying to say, put teachers in the classroom. And that's the bottom line. What happened, however, was we have, schools have always been built, this law, I think, is good because schools have always been built on inclusion. We let everybody in the building. A lot of our students who are disabled are served in our school system, and then what happens, they disappear. We never see anyone come back. Very rarely, especially in a small district like ours, do we have the disability, able to hire people with disabilities. What happens now is our students see everybody from all walks of life. Our custodians from PHC right now have been accepted by our students, accepted by our community. And that's something you can't, how do you put a quantified value on that? You know, people with disabilities are the largest minority group in the country. And yet, as we know, over 65% of them are unemployed. So this gives them an opportunity to work in a wonderful place. It's also a good place for role models. We have some of our students who are disabled who are now helping out. They see role models in a positive way. So this is the only thing I can address. I can address this part. I can also mention that schools are built around the concept of inclusion, and I hope that there is some kind of compromise down the road that needs to be looked at. But I do know that PHC has done a very good job for us. Small contractors from our area have not been able to meet the needs of our school district. We had one before. And they were QRF that came in from local was not able, never done a school. So we said, wow, we're going to go out. PHC came in, still price was so much lower that we had to look at it. They came in and they've been doing a great job. That's a long way out from Portland. So that's something I wanted to mention to you. I also want to mention that, you know, this particular concept is difficult, very emotionally charged. And this is not a politically wise place for me to be today. But I wanted to come up and tell you that I understand your pain, trying to bring the two people together. We never want to cut jobs anywhere. And we believe in the future, as the economy grows in Oregon, and all the people that are working with this, we will come up with a solution. Oregon's a great place. I came here 10 years ago, and I would never leave. So I'm really excited about the opportunity to be here today. I want to add to you that the diversity, again, for the QRFs is phenomenal. Diversity that our kids get to see. And that is an unsung part of the law that you don't get to see. But it's something I definitely get to see. We also have people who show up here who are very happy to be able to work with young people. And we do not have the means in our small district to, you know, do all the background checks and things. These people are medical, as we looked at it, medical experts have told us that the people who are hired in these cases are classified with a disability. And that's something we don't have time to do. We don't have to supervise them with the money or anything. All we do is they feel part of the team. We invite them for our in-services, and everyone seems to be working well together. So that's really all I needed to say. I just wanted to say it was a very difficult decision to contract out. No one ever wants to cut a job, but unfortunately in education we're looking for every dime. Every dime that we save goes into the classroom, and that's what our mission is. We always look at a chess match. They're all the pawns up front. Without the pawns, all those big, powerful pieces mean nothing. The pawns are the teachers in the classroom taking care of those students. And we got to take care of each and every one of them. So every time we save a dollar, we put a teacher. And that's what our philosophy was. We have closed 3 schools in our district in the last 5 years. We've done everything we can to cut costs. And this is one of the things that has been beneficial to us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you very much. Have a safe trip home.
Thank you.
Could I have Mary Bodkins and Rob Wagner, please?
I'm pretty brief. You go ahead.
We're deciding the order of the batter here. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. We represent 21,000 Oregonians who work in public and nonprofit facilities around Oregon. Interestingly enough, we're in an awkward situation, some may think, because we also represent folks who work within this industry. We represent some of the group homes, and our clients in those group homes are seriously, seriously disabled individuals. They are, under the current law, forced to compete with the giants in the industry. But before we go there, let me tell you why we introduced 3281 and why we're, or 3271 and why we're supporting 3281. We're seeking a solution that will level the playing field for our clients who have serious physical disabilities and are being forced into competing with otherwise able-bodied citizens. They are being, a number of these folks are being forced into non-union, dead-end jobs with miserable wages and no benefits. We also are attempting to protect our current members who are forced to compete with this client base. And we think that there is a balance. We have three goals for this legislative session in regards to this bill. We want to protect the rights of our clients who have serious and physical or mental disabilities to be able to access employment opportunities that bring stability and dignity to their lives. We do not want them trapped in poverty and dependent on a system that holds them hostage in sub-minimum wage jobs. Our current system creates a class of individuals who are exploited in the name of opportunity and good policy. We want the system to again be responsive to the needs of the seriously disabled. Two, we want these clients to be fully integrated into the workforce as full status employees with all the union contract protections, benefits, and salary that are associated with that status. Three, we want a process that identifies those who are truly disabled and need assistance and deserve special accommodations from those individuals who simply cannot find a job. We think they're different groups. When we looked at all the different definitions of what constitutes a disabled person, what we found was you can't be against the current definitions in law. It's not possible. Not and call yourself a humane individual. But when you go to how those definitions have been interpreted, it becomes very problematic for us. Over the years, we've tried, and we have, worked with the Disabilities Commission and the disability community, and we've taken a lot of the lead from them about what we need to do in our work sites and how we can best make our work sites accessible to folks with disabilities. And it's important to understand that a number of our members are disabled working in the workforce. And so we think that we've done a pretty good job of integrating. Do we need to do better? Yes. We've gone so far as when, about three sessions ago, I believe it was, there was a move by prison industries to displace disabled workers and have inmates do it because inmates were, quote unquote, cheaper. They were cheaper even than the disabled community. Well, we stepped in and said that is not what the intent was, and we made prison industries and those folks back off and recontract with the disabled community. Make no mistake that the advocacy groups are business now, a very big business. They have executives making in excess of $100,000 a year, while their clients limp along on wages as low as 3 cents an hour. Who can compete with that? That was reported in the paper this morning. 3 cents an hour. All I'm asking is for this committee to think about what is our goal, servitude or independence. These same advocacy groups now want more exemptions. They want to be exempted from the 8-hour day. They want to be exempted from holiday pay, overtime, vacation pay. This is not advocacy. It is government-subsidized exploitation of some of our most vulnerable citizens. Do not misunderstand our position. We believe that everybody who is covered under the broadest definitions of disabled need assistance and specialized assistance. We believe they need access to full-time employment and appropriate support on the job. What we don't believe is that we don't think they should eliminate or compete with those workers who fall into the category of the seriously disabled and who, after replacement, will probably qualify for the same QRF program as replacement. We just found out that our new public safety standards and training facility, which is going to be built out here off of State Street, is going to be forced to contract for janitorial services, food service, and security. It is troubling to us that this workforce will always be part-time, will always be temporary, and will never have a permanent commitment to the DPSST training facility or the public safety officers that they are responsible for cleaning and feeding and making sure it's secure. If you have a temporary workforce, you have a temporary commitment, and that is what we're creating, and that's what we're creating out there. One of the things that we think would be interesting to examine would be if the state of Oregon Vocational Rehabilitation and Disability Services would offer to the private sector the same subsidized employment programs that they're offering to the public sector. If they offered to the private sector the same kind of individuals with job coaches and wage subsidies that they're offering to take public sector jobs. Why not do what we used to do at one point, which is say to the employer, we will give you subsidized programs for up to a year or 2 years if you agree to fully integrate this worker at the end of that period. I think that is an appropriate way to handle this. This should not just be a way to further indenture the disabled community into no future jobs and at wages that are just appalling. I looked at one of the contracts and I thought I had miscalculated, that I could not believe that what I had figured was correct, because it said they made 20 cents an hour. Imagine my shock when I read the Oregonian this morning and found out that 20 cents an hour is pretty good. Some people only make 3 cents an hour. I find this just appalling and a complete and total misuse of what we envisioned the program to be. We believe, as a public sector union, that it is our job and our responsibility to work with our employers to fully integrate the workforce, regardless of race, religion, or physical abilities. If a person can do the job for 6 months and the job needs to be done, then they should be hired to do the job. If they're not hired to do the job because of their disability, the state of Oregon or the local government should be sued. It is against the law to discriminate against this group of workers. You need to hold your employers, the ones that you are responsible for, accountable to fully integrate the workforce. Not part-time, not temporarily, but permanently. Bring these folks in and make them part of the workforce. This seems pretty simple to us. We don't need to build an industry where the execs make $100,000 a year on the backs of workers making 3 cents an hour. We need to bring them into the workforce, and we need to require that every government agency at every level bring these folks into the workforce as fully integrated workers, not as some kind of contract scheme that doesn't seem to be working. And I do, for the record, I do have written testimony. I had a lot of technical issues this morning with the computer system, and I will print it out and make it available so the committee doesn't have to, like, you know, guess. But anyway, in closing, we just want to say that we think that, you know, if not these bills, then what? We have met several times in meetings in efforts to find some solution. It is difficult to come to a solution when one part of the disagreement refuses to talk. And that is what happened at our last meeting. I mean, the folks on the other side of this issue just simply wouldn't speak. And so, you know, it's hard to come to an agreement when you're not... Bargaining requires that you have a conversation, and conversation means that I say something and you respond to it. That didn't happen. And we have assured Representative Schaffler that we will continue to come to the meetings, be they productive or not, because we don't want to be seen as the ones who are trying to stop progress on a solution, because we do believe there is a solution available, and we do think that Mr. Wilson's right. Next session, the only difference will be there'll be more of us, and there'll be more of his clients on this table, at this table, asking you to find a solution, and the solution becomes harsher each and every session, not easier. And so I think we should see if we can't find some solution now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary. And in your testimony, you may have touched on this, but our QRFs exempt from minimum wage?
Yes.
And so there, it's...
Mr. Chair, it is appalling. It is absolutely appalling. I will make sure that you have a copy of the Oregonian article from today if you didn't get it at your office. But it is pretty... they don't have to pay minimum wage. The Oregonian stated that the wages ranged... From, and I'm reading from the Oregonian. Let's see, the medium range for the employees was $2.64 an hour. The average hourly rate wages, average, ranged from 3 cents an hour to $7.93, with 122 making less than $2 an hour. You know, Mr. Chair, my husband used to be a computer technician. I can't even imagine how he would ever compete with 3 cents an hour, because he couldn't compete with Sri Lanka or wherever to keep his job. And now, from reading this article, I find out that the QRFs provide computer technology skills as well. So, since he's an old guy, maybe I'll send him over and see if he can get some subsidized employment that way.
Can you tell me, are the QRFs, they're created by statute, and so are they subject to any public auditing or assistant?
Well, I assume that since there was an audit done by the Secretary of State, that there is some auditing requirements, and that the state of Oregon, that the Secretary of State can, of course, audit any state program, and this would be considered a state-subsidized program. You know, I just think you're going to need, I think we really need some very serious changes to how the interpretations and the definitions and everything else are managed, and how we make sure that people are obeying the law. I was pretty upset by hearing that PHC or whatever it is did not even have the ability to fulfill the contract that they took from the Portland janitors. And I know, you know, I've testified to this before, but I have a close friend who was one of those janitors, and this woman is as disabled as most of the people in this room are, and she hasn't worked again because she's too damaged to find another job. And part of her injuries were caused on the job, and her workers' comp, of course, has run out now. But it is very distressing when you see somebody that you know who's disabled as well being sort of thrown aside in favor of a new disabled person. You know, we just need to figure out a solution. It's not, the disabled population is not the problem. It's the people who are taking advantage of them that are the problem. Let's make no mistake about that.
Thank you, Mary. Rob?
Mr. Chair, Rob Wagner with the American Federation of Teachers. I'm looking at the clock on the wall there, and I know that you have a lot of people that have signed up to testify on this bill. So in order to be sensitive to the interests of the public, in order to get their voices on the record on this too, I'll just say in terms of our position, we're very much in support of House Bill 3281. And believe that this will end the exploitation of the original law, which is displacing custodians and other long-serving and talented and very skilled school-related personnel through non-competitive bidding. AFT Oregon members in Portland include the Portland Federation teachers and classified employees, which are educational assistants and physical therapy assistants and secretaries and others. And when the PHC contract was awarded, they actually started keeping a file of all the complaints they received at the union office about the condition of the buildings. I think that there are custodians here who can who have been displaced who will probably speak a little bit more to their experiences. But I'll just say, I was going to share some of them, but I won't, just because I know there's a lot of people that want to testify. But in terms of witnessing the decline of service from routine maintenance to more serious conditions that are really pretty sketchy, that there is reason for concern. And now, just so you know, and this, I was going to address this, Representative Kitts as well, the Hillsborough School District, which I believe is the fourth largest school district in the state, is threatening to contract out custodians, night custodians, and groundskeepers. And what we're asking you to do is just restore fairness, honor the intent of the original legislation, let our members compete on a level playing field, and pass House Bill 3281 this legislative session. I know we'd be willing to sit down and chat, but I think that what's happening with custodial services deserves great attention this legislative session, and we hope that we'll gain your support for this legislation.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Going to have Roger Martin and Tim Carl?
Crawl.
Crawl. And Nan Heim, please.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin. I'm a registered lobbyist. I have no client involved in this fight whatsoever. I'm here on a personal conviction. I was a member of the 1977 legislature that passed this law, and I'd like to give you a little background. In 1977, the Oregon Legislature unanimously approved House Bill 3093, sponsored by Dave Frohmeyer, then a legislator, later Attorney General, now the President of the University of Oregon. It passed the House 54-0 and the Senate 28-0. It was landmark legislation that has been copied in numerous other states, although it originally probably came a copy of the federal law. It was first suggested to Dave Frohmeyer by the Pearl Buck Center in Eugene as a way to answer a question that was growing at the time. Apparently, this is not just a local attempt to repeal this law, because the New York Times has called Frohmeyer in the last week and asked him what his opinion was of this effort around the country. And it kind of follows what's happening with prison industries around the country, where these kind of programs, prison industries at the federal level, are being attacked by both businesses and organized labor. Like Frohmeyer and almost everyone else, I think everyone else that was involved in 1977, I've been convinced today, as I was then, that we did the right thing. In the mid-1970s, the legislature made a commitment to the mental, to the disabled community. And I ask you, we made that commitment, and I would like you to consider endorsing it again today. As we downsized, and I want you to understand what was happening in the 1970s. At one point, the state institutions, the mental health institutions of the state, Mental Hospital, Fairview, and other like institutions, were a big, big part of our budget, far greater than what you're arguing about now with basic school support. A large percentage went to that. The medical community had come up with drugs to treat some of the mental problems that were going on. And we made a commitment to people that were in those institutions, as we release them back to the communities, we would provide community mental health programs, and I'll leave it to you to decide whether that's been done well. I don't think it's been done well. I think it's been underfunded. But we decided we weren't going to treat those people for their disabilities, we would send them back again. The second commitment we made is we're going to find a program to supply jobs for these people. And that's what we're talking about today. And quite apparently, that has been a very successful effort around this state. Now, you have to balance what's going on here. This is saved. This effort started in 1977. It saved the state of Oregon and your commitment for funding millions of dollars over the last almost 30 years. As we start to nibble on the edges of it, I become very worried. I've gone through this as a lobbyist that at one time did represent an institution. When you talk about sitting down to negotiate, the only negotiation you're going to end up with is cutting this program. It's not going to be the, and every time we get into this argument about how do we define the disabled, we didn't argue that in 1977. We did not say you had to be severely disabled. We just simply label it disabled. And I defy you to come up with some, because many disabilities are not visible. If you have profound epilepsy, you're probably not going to look any different than I do, except when you have one of those episodes. So I don't think you can define it. I have another reason for being here in opposition. I have a cousin who has been the recipient of this program for 30 years. Susan Neese, who is almost 60 years old, was born blind. She was born very prematurely in an era when medical facilities weren't available. She didn't have the proper drops put in her eyes, so she was born blind. She's mentally handicapped, and she has palsy. She was a longtime resident at the Oregon State School for the Blind. She returned to her own community, and for 30 years she's worked at the Edwards Center in Aloha at a kind of a job that none of us in this room would like to have. It would bore all of us to death within one day, and she loves her job. And she's not paid the minimum wage. She's paid less than minimum wage, and that doesn't matter to her. She's got a meaningful job every day she can go to that center. And I don't want to see people like that. There are thousands of others in Oregon. And at one point, as freshman legislators, you were required, we don't have those institutions anymore, to visit the state institutions. And it was an experience that I wish all of you could have gone through. Some of them were kind of funny. Some of them were very sad. And the one nobody wanted to go to was Fairview. We did not want to go view what was the people that were living at Fairview. One of those individuals, so profoundly disabled that nobody wanted to even deal with him, the last I heard, was managing one of these set-aside programs over in Dallas, Oregon. Now, we've gotten something out of that as legislators, and I hope you'll remember that, and very seriously, don't consider making big changes in this program. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. I'm going to go to you, Nan, or whichever order you want to do it there. That'll work out fine.
Chairman Brown, members of the committee, my name is Tim Krall, and I'm director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. Our members are nonprofits around the state who provide jobs and housing for people with disabilities. Behind me, you can see a small number of the 4,000 people whose jobs are on the line with these bills. There are more in the overflow room downstairs. We want you to know how strongly we oppose these bills, and we have attached, oops, which I didn't give you. We've attached a list of over 100 organizations, businesses, nonprofits, advocacy bodies who have reviewed these bills and join us in their opposition. They come from all parts of the state. They represent conservatively over 15,000 voters. I'd like to give you a snapshot of the law today. Everyone involved has a certified disability. In your packet and tabbed, you could go to the first page of the administrative rules and read the definition of disabled individual. A person who has a physical or mental impairment, a residual limiting condition resulting from injury, disease, or congenital defect that so limits their functional capabilities, such as mobility, communication, self-care, self-direction, work tolerance, or work skills, that the individual is not able to engage in normal competitive employment over an extended period of time, and as a result must rely on specialized employment opportunities provided by QRS. Later, in the same administrative rule packet of 20 pages, on page 14, the Department of Administrative Services lists who's certified to do disability status documentation. We submit there is a definition, that the definition is clear, and that the definition is being used. The law, as Mr. Martin has said, has never changed. The language has not changed. It is not expanded. It is not contracted. There is an unquestionable need for more employment opportunities for people with disabilities. Every expert, every poll, every person with a disability will tell you that. And laws like Oregon's are common. Federal government, as Mr. Martin said, was the model. There are now over 40 states that have similar laws. This is not radical. This is an accepted approach to a long-standing problem of tremendously high rates of unemployment for people with disabilities. The Harris poll that came out this month, again, shows 65% of people with disabilities who want employment are unemployed. Without laws like Oregon's, many of the people in Oregon would be unemployed, and their wages do significantly reduce their dependence on public supports. Department of Administrative Services did a study that indicated they followed one group of people for a year. For every dollar they earned in wages under one of these contracts, there was $1.15 reduction in public supports. The state of Oregon has saved millions by employing these people. The program, in our opinion, is quite modest. It's less than 1% of public purchases, and it has remained stable over the last 7 years with one exception, and that's the Portland Public Schools contract. That one contract in that 1 year caused almost a $10 million growth in the program. The rest of the 7 years, it's been less than 2%. It's been flat. We think we are reaching capacity for what qualified rehabilitation facilities can do in Oregon. There are billions and billions in public purchases. We're talking about $40 to $50 million. The paper said $50 million was projected for this year. Our studies say that it's $42 or $43 million for last year. The program, as I said, is the most regulated in the country. There's no other state that requires an independent CPA audit for the number of hours, a disability is certified. Not even the federal government requirements are that severe. Additionally, there are a number of exemptions to the competitive bid process. The application of the public contracting code, which is also attached, lists 32 exemptions to the public contracting code, including hours. And when a purchaser makes a decision on a purchase, they have a number of laws to consider, some of which take precedence over the products of disabled individuals. The inmate law does take precedence. It has a clause in it that they should consider the impact on developmental disabilities. It doesn't mention other kinds of disabilities, but at the director's discretion, it takes precedence. The Randolph-Shepard Act for visually impaired takes precedence. And there are other considerations for minority women-owned emerging small businesses. We are an exemption to competitive purchasing. That's true. We are a small population with a high rate of unemployment. That was the logic then, and it's the logic now. We understand the concerns that public employees' unions have about losing jobs. Privatization is natural for, it's a natural opposition for them. This law doesn't affect privatization. Those decisions are made exclusive of who is going to perform the contract in the private sector. Our law has no bearing on whether the Hillsborough School District goes out. If there's not a QRF available, if nobody can be suitable, it will go to a private contractor. Those, they're not connected. The opposition from the National Federation of Small Business, as JL stated, their philosophy is that all contracts be competitively bid. There's a natural opposition to any set-aside, whether it's inmate labor, whether it's Randolph-Shepard Act, whether it's this law. That's the nature of their business. Private business would like to see all contracts competitively bid. As Roger said, we don't see any way to negotiate on this. There are clarifications, perhaps, around definition of disability, although it seems very clear to us and has worked. But to deny opportunities to a population that is already so underrepresented in the employment sector just seems to us to be wrong and the wrong approach. Thank you. I'm also going to, submit testimony from the Advisory Council to the Department of Administrative Services and from the Governor's Commission on Disabilities.
Thank you, Tim.
Mr. Chair, I'm Nan Heim, representing the Oregon Rehabilitation Association, in opposition to House Bills 3271 and 3281. 3271 cuts the heart out of the products of the disabled law by eliminating the exemption from competitive bidding. And I want to explain to you why our organizations are often unable to submit the lowest bid. Number one, productivity. It might take 3, 4, or more people with disabilities to do the same amount of work as one person without a disability. Transportation. Our organizations often have to have expensive special vans to transport people with disabilities to a work site. Extra supervision. This is what supported employment is all about. It's not exploitation. It's supported employment. It's special assistance from staff of our organizations to make sure that people with disabilities get their medications when they need them, to make sure that they get assistance when they have crises that occur as a result of their disabilities when they're on the job. These are reasons that competitive bidding is unrealistic for our organizations and for the people whom we serve. House Bill 3281 exempts some public bodies from the products of the disabled law. We submit to you, as has been said, that these bodies will still contract out for some services and goods, as the superintendent said. It will the only difference will be that all of the contracts will go to private industry instead of almost all the contracts, as is now the case. Many jobs for people with disabilities stand to be lost. You've heard from Roger about the history of the law. You've heard from Tim about the current status. I'd like you to take a minute to look at the future. The population of people with disabilities is not shrinking. It's growing. This past Sunday, the Oregonian ran a front-page story about a mother taking care of foster children born to mothers addicted to methamphetamine. These children, and there are apparently hundreds of them that have been born in the last few years, have a myriad of disabilities: cerebral palsy, mental retardation, a variety of behavioral and emotional disorders. And by the way, mental retardation is the most common disability of the people we serve. The next most common is mental illness. And yes, it is quite possible that a person with one of these disabilities may look very much like any one of us and still be seriously impaired in terms of having employment. The disabilities that these children born to methamphetamine-addicted mothers have will likely remain with them throughout all their lives, just as they are likely to remain the state's responsibility, however you choose to address that responsibility. I ask you to think about what kind of future you envision for these children and for Oregonians with disabilities. Is it a future of going back to institutionalizing some of them at a cost the state cannot afford? There are not enough sheltered workshop types of jobs for everyone to handle, to meet the demand. Will it be a future in which many more of them are jobless and possibly homeless? Or will it be a future that offers them some hope of a job, some hope of leading a productive life, even though they may still be partially on public assistance? Having a job for them is about having a sense of worth. The goal of our organizations is to provide people with disabilities a job and a chance for leading a life with productivity and some independence. We very much consider the state our partner in trying to reach that goal. We ask today that you continue this partnership, that you continue to offer some hope to people with disabilities, and that you reject these bills that would do so much to destroy that hope. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Nan. Representative Schoenfeld.
Thank you. Thank you for coming here today, folks. And I definitely want to continue to have hope in the hearts of everybody in Oregon, especially this group of folks that needs it more than I do. I guess the problem I have with one thing that was said about the no need or no way to negotiate. I think that is a real sticking point. And I what I want people to do is try and find a way where we can have some slots in the workforce that are dedicated to folks that need help. Whether I'm here, whether we're up here, whether it's now, whether it's 10 years from now, I think there's change going to come about. And whether it's good or bad, I don't know. But I really think we need to work hard and try hard to find some way to work together and shape this around, because the opposition to this, and once again, I want to reemphasize, I will continue to support keeping this in statute and trying to provide jobs for folks that need help. But it's grown from the last session I was here, and I'm confident it will continue to grow. And if we wait, the longer we wait, I think the more harm is going to be done. So when folks come in and say there's no room for negotiation, no need to, and I interpret that as no need to sit down and talk, no need to try and find some kind of solution to what is a growing, increasing problem, well, that just continues to create tension, and eventually it'll break, and I don't know which way it's going to break. So I just really encourage people to be careful when they say there's nothing to negotiate, because there is always something to negotiate in everything we do in this building. So I just urge you, please, to be careful with that.
Mr. Chair, could I respond?
Certainly.
I just want to give you an example of the kind of thing that happens when you start these negotiations. The federal penitentiary out at Sheridan has about 3,000 inmates. At one time, they had a furniture program that employed about 700 people. Under pressure from the furniture manufacturers of this country, they negotiated. They now have 175 people working, and they have that many more people don't have jobs. I understand what you're saying, but I also want you to understand that in the end, the people that will lose in this will be those people that have the handicaps. They will be denied some of the jobs they have today. So please be cautious when you demand that we negotiate something that may not be solvable.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Martin, I'm not demanding anything. I've learned that demanding gets you nowhere. But that's just my opinion. But I appreciate your response. Thank you.
One of the people that were testifying just ahead of you mentioned 3 cents an hour wage, and as apparently it was in an article in the Oregonian I didn't see. But how would you respond to that, Tim?
Representative Brown, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Yeah, I intended to, and I'm sorry, I forgot, because it just came out today. I have no doubt that's a fact. I mean, Jeff Kossoff, the guy who wrote the Oregonian Reporter, talked to me probably 50 times. In and of itself, that sounds absurd, that anybody could earn 3 cents an hour on the face of it. The cost to employ somebody, to have an individual who is so severely disabled as that individual is, to remain at a workstation, we don't have any choice. If somebody's engaged in remunerative activity, we are legally required to pay them, whether it's a penny an hour or whatever. If we have a subminimum wage certificate, which is not all QRFs use them, some do, some don't, most do. Some private businesses use them. They're not restricted to qualified rehab facilities. It's an application process you go through with a wage an hour. It's 14C of federal wage an hour. Essentially, you have to demonstrate that the individual's productivity because of the disability is so severe that they can't be normally productive on that job, whatever it is. Once that's done, you have to do periodic productivity assessments of the individual. You have to compare their output to a person without disabilities and pay them a percentage of whatever the prevailing wage is in the community. So that 3 cent an hour person may be on a $10 an hour job. I don't know what it is. But whatever the prevailing wage in the community for that job is, that person is getting a percentage of that. If we want to have, and I haven't seen the individual. I have seen individuals and have worked. I started in this field in January in 75 in a residential group home in Portland. Somebody who's at that level of of earning is obviously not producing very much. We have to pay them if they're working. And if that's therapeutic, if for that individual to be in that, whatever he's doing, some sort of hand-over-hand job, we don't have a choice. I mean, we could take him out of work and say, it's not worth our time, it's not worth his time to even be in a paid employment opportunity. But if that's something he values, then we're going to do it. As absurd as a 3 cent an hour salary sounds, I don't have Jeff's story in front of me, but he looked at the average wage of people on subminimum wages. Most of the people on the in the products of disabled individuals law are not on subminimum wage, because most of those jobs take a fairly high level of productivity. Even though the individuals need support for competitive employment, they get support, but they still are producing at a fairly normal level. So they're not on subminimum wage. Those are restricted to individuals that you have. Again, it's expensive to do. You have to certify, you have to do annual, every 6 months, productivity tests. We simply wouldn't be able to employ them because of their level of productivity if we didn't use that program. So the alternative would be, okay, you have to pay everybody minimum wage, then we would simply be forced to say, all right, a category of individuals whose disabilities are so severe cannot be employed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Schoffler.
You know, these folks that are at that sub-minimum wage and the 3 cents per, I think as a layman looking in on this, those are the very folks that this was intended to reach. And no one, I think, in this room will argue with that.
Roger.
It's as the degree of ability goes up, where that line's drawn. I'm in a labor union, when I was in the labor union on the job site, and I've used this before, everybody on the job site is of varying ability. But everybody gets the same rate, depending on what your job and skill level are. It's where that line's drawing is where folks are struggling. We've had these conversations, and I hope we continue to have the conversations, if we call them negotiations or not. And that's, but these folks we're talking about, those are, in my opinion, this layman's opinion, those are the very people this statute was meant to reach. And I agree with that, and I support that, and I want them to have the dignity of being productive. And I hope and pray everyone believes me when I say that. But that's what this was intended to do. It's as that degree of ability goes up, where that line's drawn, and who's eligible, I think, is the crux of this issue here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Any other questions? Representative, thank you very much for your testimony. Could I have Jerry Egger and Bob Demon and Mike Kokler? Good morning, gentlemen. You can start in any order you'd like up there.
Chairman Brown and committee, I'm here to testimony for HB 3281 and HB 3271. We are a small lawn and landscape maintenance company. There are three of us working in my small business. I have worked in this industry for over 18 years.
Excuse me a minute, sir. I need your name for the record.
Mick Kokler.
Thank you. Thank you, sir. Go ahead.
Clint has worked with me for over 12 years, and my other worker, Jose, has been working with me for over 7 years. Clint has two daughters and is raising three other children whose parents were killed. Jose is also raising children. He has three children. Two of his daughters are disabled. We worked hard to get the Monroe School District and the Lane County Youth Facility. We had to go through a competitive bidding process to get these jobs. There was a great deal of extra work to get these accounts in shape. We service Monroe School District for 7 years in Lane County Youth Facility over 3 years. When the time came to rebid, a nonprofit firm, Cornerstone, came in and took the bids without competitive bidding. To date, we have lost over $50,000 per year of work to nonprofit firms claiming to employ disabled individuals to operate all types of equipment under the products of disabled individuals law. I have not been able to give either of my employees a raise due to losing business to nonprofits under the products of disabled individuals law. It appears to me that we may be faced with laying off Jose, but we will only do that as a last resort. We need your help. Fortunately, we didn't have any equipment payments or we couldn't have kept going. We have not been able to afford to replace our equipment. Please pass House Bill 3281, House Bill 3271 to make it fair for small business to continue to operate in Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you, Mitch, for your testimony. Next, please.
Mr. Chairman and committee, my name is Bob Deenan. I'm the owner of Dependable Printer Support, doing business as DPS Incorporated. I've been in business since 1992. DPS Incorporated remanufactures and sells toner cartridges as well as services and maintains laser printers, fax machines, copiers, and shredders. DPS has locations in Portland and in Salem and serves the Willamette Valley. I've not always operated a remanufactured toner cartridge operation. From 1979 through 1988, I was a teacher in a severely handicapped learner classroom. And I have a master's degree in education with an emphasis in special education in the severely handicapped. This combined with my current business has provided me with a unique perspective on the products of disabled individual law. While I was teaching, I applied for grants to extend the training and supervision of students all year round. For some, we would find them entry-level positions as dishwashing, busing tables, nursery work, cleanup work at a manufactured home factory. For others, we would provide training in the area of work habits and pre-employment skills. My goal was to find work for handicapped students in the private sector, empowering them to maximize their employment, self-sufficiency, and independence. Unfortunately, it has become apparent that the strategy pursued by the large nonprofits in using the products of disabled individual law is not to promote the independence of the handicapped, but further restricts them and makes them a permanent part of another institution. Before I explain how this law has adversely affected my business, I wish to point out an extremely important aspect of the products of disabled individuals law that is not commonly understood. Despite the law's title, its purpose is not the employment of people with disabilities. The purpose of the law is to promote the employment of people who are not competitively employable because of the nature of their disability. This distinction is extremely important. An extremely important part of understanding this law and the legislature's intent passing it 28 years ago. Remanufacturing toner cartridges is a complex precision process requiring manual dexterity, attention to detail, and technical knowledge. It is not clear a disabled individual, as defined in the statute, could remanufacture cartridges. Not because a person with a disability could not do the task inherent in remanufacturing a toner cartridge, but because having that ability would demonstrate that he is competitively employable. Frankly speaking, it is so difficult to reliably remanufacture a toner cartridge that if a handicapped person could do it, I would be more than happy to hire him. It is important in understanding the impact of this statute on my business. I have currently lost $17,000 worth of public business to Step Forward Activities, a QRF. Potentially, I could lose $71,000 per year of remanufactured toner cartridge business if QRF supply other public entities through other mandated contracts. If DAS allows Step Forward Activities to continue to promote the servicing of office equipment, which they do, to those locations, the total lost would be easily over $160,000 per year to my company alone. It is my understanding Step Forward Activities will be producing remanufactured products at their facility in Baker by disabled individuals. In fact, we know that inmates at the Powder River Correction Facility will be declared to be disabled to perform this work. Step Forward constructed a building behind the prison walls for the purpose of remanufacturing toner cartridges. step forward to sell through the products of disabled individual law. Inmates are not the disabled population described by the products of disabled individual law of 1977. The determination that inmate labor fits under the products of disabled individuals law is indicative of the true problem with this program. For 28 years, the Department of Administrative Services failed to provide any form of meaningful regulation to the program. DAS, in their zeal to promote the program, has completely failed to enforce the program's statutory requirements. The result is an estimated dollar amount of about $80 million in contracts being awarded without oversight and without serving the severely disabled. Estimated because DAS does not bother to track the contracts under this program. I have volunteered, donated time, taught severely handicapped students. It is my sincere desire that the population of severely disabled individuals intended to be served by the products of disabled individuals law is protected and given employment. This will not be accomplished if QRFs or qualified rehabilitation facilities are allowed to use inmates and people are able to compete fully in part-time or full-time employment. In my conclusion, I fully support House Bill 3271 and HB 3281. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob. Jerry, please.
Chair Brown, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Egger, and I'm the owner of Mid Valley Presort and Mailing in Salem, Oregon. I employ over 20 individuals, and some of those individuals are disabled. I am a member of the National Federation of Independent Business and also a founding member of the Fair Competition Alliance. I'm here today to express my support for 3271 and 3281, essentially because the system's broke. It needs to be fixed. The legislative history minutes indicate the statute was not intended to cover anybody with any type of a disability. On March 1977, Mr. Spaulding spoke on behalf of the Oregon Association of Rehabilitation Workshops and Facilities, in addition to the Pearl Buck Center, in favor of, at that time, House Bill 3093. He stated that the bill will provide a source of work at little or no cost to the state. He stated that the bill does not relate to all handicapped persons, regardless of the degree of handicap or place of employment, but only to nonprofit activity centers and sheltered workshops that provide employment and vocational training to handicapped persons. As a small business, I've lost money, I've lost opportunity, and to date I've spent well over 8,000 or 9,000 hours researching this law. I've been involved in work groups. I've participated in DAS mediation, specifically with a focus on the definition of disabled individual. And Representative Schaffler's words today are very wise. It needs to take all parties together. We need to discuss this issue and bring out the details that are below the surface that the legislature is not able to see. One example of those details are, for example, only just recently, within the last 2 years, DAS has issued public notices for suitability to give businesses and affected parties an opportunity to protest the taking of their property by nonprofit entities, some of whom we do not believe employ the legislative intended target population. And so, essentially, what we have here is a definition that nobody really understands and nobody's willing to take a position on. It would be very instructive for the committee and possibly Chair Brown to ask the Department of Administrative Services about the qualified rehabilitation application forms that were used to administer and certify these programs, and especially these rehabilitation facilities since 1978. You'll find that those application certification statements and direct labor requirement lines use the terms severely handicapped and severely disabled. Only recently those forms have been changed, and that gets into a discussion of the new administrative rules that went from, depending upon how you print it out, from 4 pages to 27. So in a recent hearing regarding DAS, one official estimated that the program was $20 million. Another estimated that it was $50 million a year. One entity now, PHC, has over $29 million in contracts. DePaul Industries has over $3 million contracts, dollars worth of contracts in unarmed security. and $6 million in contracts for temporary staffing services. It's clear that DAS does not have the willingness or ability or the staff or the funding to properly administer this program. The comprehensive approach in these two bills at least will correct some of the abuses and restore fairness. Although I believe in the original intent of the legislation to promote the employment of severely disabled individuals, it's not what is happening today, at least not in my business. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. Could I have Justin Martin and John Murphy and Robert Stewart, please? Go ahead, Justin. We'll start with you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Justin Martin. I'm here today on behalf of Portland Public Schools. We urge you to oppose House Bill 3271 and House Bill 3281. Both those bills would impact an area of Oregon's procurement law that is working quite well. Portland Public Schools decided to contract out for custodial services beginning in fiscal year 2002-03. The purpose of the contract was to reduce custodial services spending in response to a revenue shortfall of approximately $36 million. We examined all departmental budgets to identify reductions that would preserve classroom resources for our primary educational mission. We determined that wages for custodial staff were higher than in surrounding districts and estimated that we could save over $5 million if the service was outsourced. In the first year, we saved about $3.7 million. In the second year, just under $7 million, $6.9 million. We feel that the QRF law is also a plus for our citizens with disabilities. The government contracts held by QRFs provide job opportunities for our community members that may otherwise have difficulty finding employment. It is easy to see the tremendous pride that they take in their jobs. We're here today for two reasons. One, we're having to make difficult decisions in the face of education funding. We've closed schools. We've just recently cut budgets. And just last week announced 261 layoffs. These are tough times. Any opportunity that we can save dollars and get the dollars where they need to be, which is in the classroom, we are going to take that. Also, secondly, we're very proud of the relationships that we have with our QRF. And again, we urge you to oppose both House Bill 3271 and 3281. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Justin. Next, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Murphy. I'm president of Portland Rehabilitation Center. And just I want you to know we are a union shop. Average wage we pay to our workers with disabilities is $11.06 an hour. People with disabilities are the most employment disadvantaged group in our country. The most recent Harris poll confirms the scale of the problem and lists some of the tragic results from this situation, like incessant poverty, hopelessness, isolation, chronic fear, and sickness rooted in neglect. The state set-aside program is direct relief for people with disabilities. The sale to the state by a QRF equals a job for people who are disabled, and it doesn't cost the state. The state gets goods and services at fair prices and saves the welfare and support costs that would otherwise incur. Opponents say this limits opportunities to compete. The world's full of opportunities for small businesses to compete. Is this narrow segment of QRF business critical to the business community? What does it mean to win a competition against people who can't compete because of their physical and mental impairments? This really isn't about competition. It's about helping people who need a place to start to help themselves. Some opponents say the local school boards need to be able to exclude people with disabilities from working in schools because they are special environments, and that the QRF law doesn't allow them this option. This is the logic of discrimination that we thought was put to rest with the 64 Civil Rights Act, or at least the Section 504 of the 73 Rehab Act, or finally with the 1990 ADA. Apparently, fear and stereotypes still have some currency. Ironically, our problem now is the law works. It has indeed, expanded employment opportunities for people with disabilities. Success means that because people with disabilities have these jobs, others do not. I think that fact is inevitable. However, I absolutely do not believe the 1977 lawmakers were hypocrites. They intended the program to succeed. They made a value judgment knowing the downside and chose to help those most in need. It's been suggested that QRF workers have only trivial impairment. This is a red herring intended to misdirect attention. Most of the people who work for QRFs have disabilities that fall under major categories like developmental disabilities, chronic mental illness, and an array of chronic illnesses and orthopedic conditions. But disability is a human, individual thing. The same accident or illness can devastate one individual while another overcomes the experience with heroic resiliency. So professional judgment and history do come into play. The regulations require an independent audit to confirm that the process and the required documentation is in place and in good order at the QRF, and this audit takes place every year. This also needs to be seen in the context of who we are. The law requires that a QRF be organized for the benefit of people with disabilities. That's a given. PHC started with a group of parents and community partners who in 1950 just wanted to build a school for children with disabilities. In those days, children with severe disabilities were excluded from public schools in Oregon. They used their own money, did fundraisers, charged tuition to provide basic education for their children. The civil rights movement changed everything. The 64 Civil Rights Act and the 1968 Handicapped Children's Education Act opened public schools for kids with disabilities. In the meantime, the kids at PHC were growing up and needed a vocational strategy. PHC started vocational training programs and did our best to place people on jobs in the community. At the same time, we began to take on contracts to do work and employ our training graduates ourselves. A unique aspect of our strategy was in the early 70s, we approached a local janitorial union to include our workers. We were hoping to get access to health benefits. The union balked at first, but when we got a federal set-aside on a downtown building, they allowed us to sign an area agreement. We've been a union shop ever since. We've been a union shop since 1974. This law came into effect in 1977. So I think that that addresses the argument that somehow this is a change and that this is a new group of workers or a new situation. It's not. It was there before the law even came about. We participate in the Contractors Association along with other union contractors in the Portland area to periodically renegotiate the area agreement. I also serve as a trustee on the local 49 Health and Welfare Trust representing the union employers. They elected me. In summary, I urge you to respect the goodness and vision of Dave Frommeyer in the 1977 legislature and don't make life harder and the prospects dimmer for Oregonians who experience disability. Thank you.
Thank you. Robert, can you give your testimony, please?
Yes. I'm Robert Stewart, and I'm here representing DePaul Industries. And I have cerebral palsy. And with this program, for any handicapped person like myself, I go into the job market with two strikes against me. Number one is they see my handicap. Oh, boy. Which leads to problem number two. Can he do the job? Well, with a job like DePaul, I don't have to worry about that. And I'm very happy for the work. And some people who do get handicaps, like myself, stay on menial jobs because they're afraid of the two arguments. He's got a handicap, and can he do the job? So we tend to stay there. But with a job like this, I've become a productive member. I'm pulling down better than average minimum wage. And I'm making a commitment to my family and to the people I work with. And it's shown in my work accordingly. In the fact that I work so well, they asked me to give my testimony. And I can testify that these type programs do work and are working for people like myself. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Thank you. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Really, I just want to make a brief comment. Many of my constituents lost their jobs when Portland Public Schools decided to contract out that janitorial work. And I guess, and I don't really know if I'm looking for a comment from the panel or not, but I just wanted to at least make a comment on the record that, you know, Portland Public Schools said that they had no choice, that they had to do this, they had to contract this out. PHC says we had no choice, we had to, an obligation to put people to work on this contract. And, you know, maybe that's so, but the nonprofit that I started back in 1998, we had a philosophy and a mission that we weren't going to undercut other workers and that our clients weren't going to prosper at the expense of other workers. And so I just wanted to suggest that Portland Public Schools, in my view, they had a choice. It might have been a tough choice, but they had a choice. They took it. PHC might, they had a choice on whether or not they wanted to go after that work. And so I guess I just wanted to close that comment and feel free to respond, but you don't have to. It's with more of a rhetorical question is, you know, why is it in this country that when we want to save cash on labor costs and benefits, that we always expect the lowest wage workers to bear the brunt? Thanks.
Thank you, Representative.
I would just say that, you know, when we went to the union to sign a contract in 1974, we weren't looking at saving money. We are a union contractor paying the full wage and benefit along with the other union contractors in our metropolitan area.
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Do you pay the same wages that the Portland Public School janitors paid?
No.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I see that I have several people that have came from over 100 miles away. Some people with Shangri-La, Jen, Carl, and Debbie Woods and Jake Norman. Sure, that'll be fine. Yeah, that'll be fine.
My name's Devil Wood. I need to tell my story. My name's Devil Wood. My name is Deborah Wood. I live in Salem ever since June 1973, for 32 years. And I'm a single 52-year-old woman. And I am a twin. I have two sisters and a brother. And I'm a premature baby was born in Florida, California. I started going to Children's Health Council in Palo Alto, California, private preschool for slow children from 4 to 8. 8 to 12, I got started going to Los Angeles Self-Help School in San Mateo, California for mentally retarded children. And in 8 to 12, I got expelled. And to go, I was very fortunate. I got expelled to go to a ranch and file for disturbed children, 12 to 16. And I moved to group home, 16 to 20. I moved back home when I was 20. I've lived with my parents ever since. We moved to Oregon and I started going to show workshop over there in Corvallis 1 year and a half. And I started going to Shangri-La in May 1975 with and share a workshop for 30 years. I like my all-seasons ground security job. I'm not going to retire until I get old. And thank you for listening.
Thank you.
I'm very excited, no man. I feel that ball has broke. It broke. My car, me, I feel that broke. My ball, and to my mom and daddy. I thank God. I love God. Mom and daddy are going to get home. Tell mommy.
Thank you.
Hello, Chairman and representatives. I'm Mary Lou Yerman. I work for ARC Manufacturing. And I'm speaking for a bunch of disability people because I've been through employment history of 27 years. And I'm speaking on both sides of the category here. Because, now, looking at me right now, could you guys tell me I have epilepsy? But when I go to the door and I sign applications and everything, as soon as I go to my interviews and I hear that word epilepsy, I've had the door shut in front of me. But thanks to Shangri-La and different other organizations around here, I've had the doors open to me. And to give you an opportunity to give you a little experience of what having a disability can do to you. Okay, I'm blind in one eye, I have epilepsy, and I got two toes go off my foot. But when I walked up front of you, now could you guys tell me that I, and lady, could you guys tell me, that I was missing two toes? No, because I compensated for it. All right, and number two, I used to work in a school system, and I volunteered. I went from volunteering to substituting. I went from substituting to being an employee as a teacher aide. And I went from being a teacher aide to being a paraprofessional. And just in case you don't know what that is, that means I work with any child that walks in that building. And I went from that to being an office assistant. And I was living in Montana at the time. And then when I moved here to Oregon, to give you guys an idea, right, 6 months in the process of me volunteering, the principal brought to my attention. She says, Mary Lou, when you signed up to be a volunteer, she says, I didn't believe the teachers and I were talking, and we thought, well, if you could do a few assignments, you'd be lucky. But she said, you know what? We can't give you enough to do. But why did they think that I wouldn't be able to do the work? Because I have epilepsy. And I'm here to speak that just because we have a disability, I might be disabled. But I want each and every one of you to understand, just because I'm disabled don't mean I'm unable to do a job. As I've proved in my 27 years of job history, through the Voc Rehab helping me and different other organizations, that I've proved to every one of them, that I'm sitting here telling every one of you, that every job that I've went out and I said, I'm capable of doing this job, I've been able to do it. But if you turn around and this bill comes into effect and all these agencies are closed down, what are we to do now but lose our jobs and have to start all over again? And you think it's easy to do? I'm here to tell you, no, it's not. Because I know what it is, like I told you guys a while ago, I know what it is to lose part of my foot and have to learn to walk again. and had to start all over again. And I am a mother of two teenage boys, and I've got one boy that's vision, hearing impaired. And right today, if I wasn't being a good role model to my son, what do you think he'd be at today? And would I have been able to be a good role model if I didn't have the past experience? No, I would not have been able to. But because I've had the past experience, I was able to be a good role model for my son. And right today, yes, I understand you guys talking about this underwage stuff. But my son works 2 hours a day at Walmart. And different other jobs he's doing, but he's getting job experience, but he gets two something an hour. But that's job experience to start out with for his disabilities. And it's going to lead up to a regular job. So I can understand what you guys are saying, but I'm only guys know a thing. When I got hired on this Shangri-La, you start with $7.80 and it works up and everything. And you're talking about minimum wage. Well, I'm up to $8.35 an hour right now. So just because some jobs are paid under the minimum wage, don't mean all of them do. And I'm here to say that to all of them. And I'm here to ask you guys to please give each and every one of us an opportunity to prove what we're capable of doing. Don't take the programs away from us.
Thank you for your testimony.
And thank you.
Thank you very much.
Please save our job, okay?
All right. Thank you very much for your testimony today.
You're welcome.
Could I have Susan Safran and Chuck Morgan, please? Thank you again. This is it.
Okay. Chair Brown and members of the committee, I'm here today representing American Building Maintenance Company. Our company employs more than 500 janitorial service employees in the state of Oregon and has been doing business in the state since 1920. During 85 years of operating in Oregon, ABM grew to become the largest private janitorial contractor in Portland and Southwest Washington. We developed a loyal customer base, which included public schools, municipalities, and the Portland International Airport. ABM's growth was done the old-fashioned way, one customer at a time, through fair pricing and quality work performance. Unfortunately, ABM is no longer the largest janitorial contractor in Portland. During the past few years, ABM has systematically lost its public jobs to qualified rehabilitation facilities, or QRFs. In this process, over 100 ABM employees have lost their jobs. In our view, there is only one reason for ABM's recent misfortune, and that is ORS 279, also known as the Products of Disabled Individuals Act. Although this law was very obviously intended to create job opportunities for severely disabled individuals, QRFs are regularly permitted to apply a definition of disabled individual which is so broad that many of us in today's hearing room could qualify as disabled individuals, despite our ability to hold down jobs and otherwise participate in active society. As an example attached to this letter is recruitment language used by one major Oregon QRF. It reminds potential employees that disabilities come in all shapes and sizes and provides a laundry list of possible reasons for someone to be considered disabled. This very obviously reaches out to job applicants who may not even consider themselves disabled. ABM does not believe that the law was intended to benefit employees who were not aware of their disabled status. With the broad definition of the term disabled, it is clear that QRFs are well beyond the original intent of the law, and thus the law is no longer helping those individuals it was intended to serve. Under the American with Disabilities Act, ORS 659400, ABM, along with most employers in Oregon, are already required to hire and retain individuals with disability, so long as they can perform the essential functions of the job. As a result, private employers in Oregon are likely to employ many individuals who are just as disabled as the disabled employees being recruited by the QRFs. Why should QRFs be given such powerful competitive advantage if they employ essentially the same workers? In ABM's case, we actively employ and accommodate individuals with disabilities and certainly employ individuals who meet the broad definition which has been permitted under ORS 279. In one example, we have an employee who has been with the company for 38 years who far exceeds the qualifications of disabled. He chooses not to be classified as disabled and certainly has proven himself a worthy employee. ABM held the Portland International Airport contract for 8 years until it was handed to a QRF without a bid process and without consideration of our years of quality service. The loss of the airport account represented $2 million per year in revenue. Last year, we lost the city of Hillsboro, which was my personal account. Against their wishes, which was a loss of $180,000 per year, and in both cases, employees lost their jobs. I've kept in close contact with both the city of Hillsboro and the Parks Department. We have been asked over the last year to bid on several of the buildings as they were not satisfied with the service that they were being provided and the cost of it. And they tried to go through the process of removing the QRF and bringing us back in. At that point, the process was stopped, and they were told that they didn't want any bad publicity, and the whole process stopped, and we were removed from the bidding process. Additionally, in both cases, these accounts were given to a QRF at substantially higher cost. Our government is required to absorb the higher costs at less than standard service. With regard to Portland Public School contract, ABM was the only local company with a qualified history of experience in schools. We were not invited to share our expertise with the Portland Public Schools, yet this contract was handed to a QRF without a competitive bid process due to the current law. Should our employees with similar disabilities lose their jobs because of the QRF? Is a person with disabilities employment more important? Do they have to change employers to be classified disabled in order to work? Should citizens and businesses pay higher taxes in under the fund the additional expense of the QRFs? QRFs don't have to keep up standards because there is no competition and no effective process to fire them for non-performance. In a fair market, this wouldn't happen. Something must be done to stop the abuse of the set-aside work for QRFs. These House bills do not solve all the problems affecting our business by this law. However, it is a step in the right direction and would allow districts the flexibility to find the best service provider and the best value for their facility. We respectfully request your support for House Bill 3281 and House Bill 3271. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Chuck. And if possible, keep it as brief as you possibly can.
I will try, Chair. Chairman Brown and members of the committee, thank you for hearing our testimony this morning. I am here in support of House Bill 3271 and House Bill 3281. My name is Chuck Morgan. I am the founder, owner, and president of Laser Care Incorporated, a Beaverton-based company. We are entering our 15th year of operation. Our customer base has mostly been those companies and public agencies located in the greater Portland area. We sell, service, and supply all things related to home and office printers. Our business is primarily based upon providing service for our customers, whether they are large or small, public or private. And currently, we have 11 full-time permanent employees that are all receiving competitive wages and benefits. These people rely on our continued success to maintain security for themselves and their families. Without exception, all of our employees strongly support both these bills because they know on a level playing field that our company will be successful. Mm-hmm. Our company provides a needed service to many public agencies and schools throughout the Portland metro area. Unfortunately, we have seen a significant loss of this business in recent years because these agencies now must purchase from QRFs. All of our employees subscribe to the intent of the current ruling, specifically that those severely handicapped individuals who require help to gain employment be provided that help. None of our employees believe that the intent of the rule includes individuals who are currently inmates in state-run facilities, individuals with alcohol or drug-related dependencies, or those who fall under the general description of the ADA. The rules were not created to serve those individuals, and in fact, those most in need of the support are going without because the work is given to others who may be more capable, cheaper, or available. As a small company, we want the opportunity to compete fairly for our clients' business. I have reviewed a sampling of public agencies we serve and are able to show a drop in sales from many of these organizations. I have not polled each of the clients, but I can assure you that when I see our company providing products and services and then no products but an increase in service calls, it almost always points to state agencies who have been forced to quit purchasing from our company but are allowed to continue to hire us to fix their printers. We have had many situations where the purchasing agent wants to continue getting our products but is told to purchase from a QRF to follow state-mandated rules. In one not uncommon occurrence, our company provided all printer repairs and supplies for the Oregon Department of Human Services in Clackamas County. We have lost over $12,000 per year in that one contract alone because it has been mandated that they purchase from a QRF. Until December 2004, which was when we last were providing those products, they were happy with our products, our technicians who took care of them, and the professional treatment they received from our staff. I conservatively estimate that there are at least 15 more DHS types of lost accounts, which would equal approximately $100,000 for our company alone. These include, but are not limited to, OHSU, Portland State, State Bureau of Labor and Industry, Oregon Fish and Wildlife, Portland Community College, many others. As a company, we can deal with losing a customer because of poor service, poor quality, or poor pricing. In fact, we gain a lot of business because of other companies' problems in these very areas. In the small business world, when we do everything right and still lose the business through unfair purchasing practices, we have a difficult time understanding that. I, as the owner, have an even more difficult time explaining this to my employees when they are looking for security and competitive pay in these tough times. Please help us all by supporting these rules, these bills. Thank you for hearing me this morning.
Representative Schaffler.
Thank you. I think anything, all these folks, I want to remain productive and work. I don't think there's anybody in the world that doesn't agree with that. Clearly, there's been a money shift here due to the way of the bidding process or lack of bidding process. And you represent a rather large company with hundreds of employees, I heard you say?
500.
And you're at 11, so I think maybe the burden may be greater on you to absorb some of this. My question is to both of you, though. I mean, if it's 1% of the workforce, and that group of folks, we want to continue to be productive and have dignity and do that. I have no doubt in my mind everyone agrees on that. It would be easier for you to absorb, especially if some training or transportation was provided, a certain number of folks that would fit into your system where they could do something. And so I'm fairly confident you'd be willing, and you've already expressed that you do that, which I commend you, even without the advantages of a QRF. Your small business, sir, due to the loss of business, I imagine if you had that business, you'd probably be able to, or be willing, if you got those contracts, be willing to provide some kind of work, some kind of labor, some kind of job to one of these folks. Because you only have 11, so if you added one person on, I mean, you're way above the ratio. So my question, and while talking to folks that are in business, do you think businesses are willing to pick up this burden, if we want to call it that, maybe that's an insensitive thing, pick up this workforce if there was some kind of change in how we go about making, providing opportunities for people to be productive and have dignity and help support themselves?
I'd like to respond briefly to what you said, Representative Larry, and all committee members. I have, even though I am a small company with only 11 employees, one of my key employees is a disabled individual. And I've hired this individual, and he is a key employee in my organization. He is he has severe epilepsy. And I've hired him. I've continued to pay him competitive wages, given him benefits with absolutely no incentive from the state at all. And so even in my company, and I hired his son also, who also has epilepsy for a period of time. And that's only 11 employees. So, yes, I know in our industry we are more than willing to take on that support.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, folks, for your testimony. Committee, I've got several people that came over 100 miles to get here to testify today, and so I'm going to allow the testimony to continue if you have, and I know some of you may have other commitments, and certainly it's with my blessing you can leave if you care to.
How many more do you anticipate? I do have a noon, but I...
Two more panels, I think. I have Tina, Jackie, and Merlene Martin.
I just want to say something.
I'm not. Yeah, go ahead, Janet.
Mr. Chair, I'm going to be passing out, while these testifiers are coming up, passing out testimony from the Department of Human Services, Vocational Rehab, and from the Department of Administrative Services. They're here to testify, but we'll just pass out their testimony instead.
Okay. Thank you, Janet.
Chairman Brown, committee members. My name is Tina Jackie. I am a custodian. I am a civil servant. I am also a former custodian of Portland Public Schools and was for 14 years until very rudely on July 8th of 2002, I and 300 plus other custodians were informed that we were no longer a part of the mission statement. Very rude awakening. You want to know what I lost? Along with my health, bleeding ulcers are no fun. It's very hard to get by when you're getting 2 hours of sleep broken at best at night for several years. I also lost my PERS status. I also lost money. This is my paycheck for this pay period. Total of $644.91. Of that, $610 goes to my rent as soon as I get it in the bank. You do the math to see what that leaves me till the next pay period, till the 15th. It's not a lot. I'm not against handicapped. Our group, we had one of the most diverse groups in around. All you had to do was take a snapshot. We had every group you could fit. We had every representatives of every group, including handicaps, people that were handicapped. Everything from multiple personality disorder. We had cerebral palsy. We had a head custodian in a high school with a physical handicap. He had a withered arm. He retired as a head custodian, not because he was given the position, but because he earned it. He earned it by doing the work. Also, we have, I'd like to submit for the file, for the record, qualified rehabilitation facility application. I would like you to read it because it has in it a list of all the contracts that qualified rehabilitation facilities. I'm not against handicap, but I was denied my right to my job, which I believe in reality could be a form of reverse discrimination, because I'm technically not handicapped. I'm not a bona fide handicapped person, although I could be. I am dyslexic. I have hemorrhoids, insomnia, and ulcers. So where does that leave me? Where does that leave the able-bodied people who are working, who are making living wage jobs? Where does that leave us? Because we got thrown out. We didn't have the opportunity to go to work for the competition. Instead, we were left out in the cold. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Good morning, Chair Brown and members of the committee. My name is Merlene Martin, and I am the state president of the Oregon School Employees Association. OSEA, you've already heard about us. We represent 20,000 education staff working in K-12 schools, education service districts, community colleges, Head Start agencies, libraries, and park and recreation districts. I'm here today to raise my voice and that of our entire membership in support of House Bill 3281. This legislation is very important to our classified members. You might ask why. Well, they happen to be the educational staff whose jobs are always at risk of being contracted out in our schools, community colleges, and education service districts. In July 2002, OSEA was shocked when 318 Portland Public School custodians were displaced from their jobs after the district contracted with the Portland Habilitation Center. Then in July of 2003, after an unsuccessful effort to stop the Rainier School District from contracting out their custodial services, we watched helplessly as employees of another qualified rehabilitation facility displaced our custodial members. Any doubts or questions that we might have had about what happened to the Portland School custodians disappeared after the Rainier School District contracting out event. Something was drastically wrong. Since that time, OSEA has spent time and resources to find out how to stop this wholesale taking of our members' jobs. What we found was the products of disabled individuals law, the PDIL. Somehow, this 1997 law had evolved from providing employment opportunities for the severely handicapped in sheltered workshops or activity centers into a law that displaces business from economic opportunities, workers from job opportunities, and turned schools into sheltered workshops. And as we reached out to other groups, as Mary suggested, to assist in finding a solution to our problems with the PDIL, we discovered that those that benefit from this evolved law had no interest in addressing our concerns, our issues. So as OSEA came to the conclusion that a solution to this problem would take time or may never happen. So OSEA joined the National Federation of Independent Businesses in requesting the introduction of House Bill 3281. OSEA believes it is absolutely critical to exempt our schools, community colleges, and ESDs from the PDIL in order to stop any further negative impact on local education districts, staff, and Oregon's small business community. In addition to being the state president of OSEA, I'm volunteer in that position, my real job is working as an educational assistant for the South Lane School District. That's in Cottage Grove. I understand the personal value of having a job. I am very proud of the work that I do every single day and the difference that I make in the lives of children. My work gives me a great sense of great self-worth and accomplishment. But if I had gained my job by taking away the job of someone else, all of that would be lost. Rather than pride, I would feel guilty. Rather than self-worth, I would feel somewhat ashamed. Speaking as an individual with a disability, and I would like to speak to Mr. Superintendent Carter's talking about having the diversity within his school district now with having disabled workers working in the school. I'm a disabled worker, and I work in my school district every day, and I take every opportunity to use my job there to educate children about my disease and about people with disabilities. And I have to say that I do visit districts across the state, and districts do not discriminate against handicapped people. And we do have people with disabilities working in our school districts. It would be more a norm than rare, that is for sure. I'm angry because this law is placing the disabled in a horrible position. It's just not fair. So finally, I know this committee will hear stories, good stories, about evolved PDIL, but there is no amount of good that can offset the wrong that this law has inflicted on working Oregonians and small businesses. I urge the committee to support House Bill 3281.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Both of you for your testimony and traveling here today.
Thank you for going over.
All right, thank you. Cool. I have Tootie Smith and Albert Verheider. Is that how I pronounce that? Okay.
Hello.
Sandra Bishop, join us too, please. Why don't you go right ahead, Albert?
Okay. Well, my name is Albert Friden. I'm here for to testify for the Palm Industries. I have Tourette's syndrome. I make, you know, funny noises and stuff. I don't know if this has really stopped employers from wanting to employ me or whatever, but I went through 4 months of not being able to get a job from October until, like, February. I worked at a factory for a month, and I got laid off, and I couldn't find a job for 4 months. And I went to DePaul, and as soon as I got my paperwork all done, I had a job the next day. This is a good thing. I'd rather be working than not. That's all I really have to say.
Thank you, Albert, for your testimony. Tootie?
Hi, thank you. I'm Tootie Smith, Government Relations for JOTA Jobs for Oregonians with Disabilities Association, and we represent private nonprofit QRFs. And I'm here today just to kind of put at ease some of the claims that have been made that we'd like to clear up. Earlier in the testimony, there's been a lot of talk about that wonderful Oregonian article in today's circulation, and since when does anybody in this building believe the Oregonian? But I will say one thing. On the graph that you'll see on front of the paper, it shows public sales, how they zoomed up from in 2002 from $31 million to $50 million. When the Portland Public Schools contracted out, they saved $11 million in a biennium, which has already been testified to. That's one reason sales has plummeted up. And another reason is since the year 2001, which was my first legislative session, and five special sessions that followed, and then after that, the state's longest regular session, and the reason for that was our declining income base had eroded. During that time since 2001, the state had to cut back special services to not only our education folks, but people with disabilities, our senior citizens, the Oregon Health Plan, and so forth. So when you cut your budgets at the state level, there's an opposite and equal reaction that happens in the private sector. And when that happens, these disabled people go to the QRFs, who are private, and put these people to work according to the law. The QRFs are working according to the law. And there's also been alluded to in earlier testimony about that huge DAS list that keeps growing. I believe J.L. Wilson alluded to the huge DAS list. I passed it out to you. And here it is. It's 12 jobs, 12 services and products that QRFs can bid in state contracts, compared to the hundreds and hundreds, it's probably not thousands, that the private sector are able to do. So I would, if I were you, please try to put that in perspective to us. There was also something made about that wonderful Oregonian article, 3 cents an hour versus $100,000 an hour. Well, the people who make $100,000 are also responsible for the employment and in keeping with the law and private contracts of over 1,000 people in their companies. And gentlemen, I would not do it for any less. And the people who make 3 cents an hour are the people who are so disabled that they have been literally taken out of their hospital beds, taken down to a center, and they do this. And then after that's done, they do this. And then after that's done, they do this. And for 3 cents an hour, they are also supplemented with federal SSI and, in some cases, Medicaid. But they do get out of the hospital, and they are not on government services, which the state legislature cut. A lot has been made about this as a wonderful, just over-far-reaching government subsidy. Well, representatives, isn't Davis-Bacon a government subsidy that unions rely on for prevailing wage on government contracts? I would say the same thing is true. And every time that a union does not get what they believe to be a government contract, they're waving their Davis-Bacon around all over the place. We have been cheated. Oh, my goodness. So I say if you're going to go after this product's a disability law, I will be the first down to legislative council to rewrite the Davis-Bacon law. Also, much has been made about if a private company bids a contract at $100,000 and then a QRF comes along and bids it at $200,000, they have to give it to the QRF. There's only one person in this room that can answer that, and that's Diane Lancaster, the Chief Procurement Officer at DAS. And, Mr. Chair, I suggest that you bring her up and answer that contract because she is the one who administers state purchasing of these contracts.
We have a written testimony.
Thank you. Maybe we should write it into testimony.
First of all, I'd like to compliment Mr. Verheider on probably the most compelling testimony I've heard all day. You want to work, you got a job, and that's good. And you short your words and concise. Appreciate that, I do. There's a lot of other things I'd like to say. I'm trying to control my passion here. I think I've made it pretty clear I want Mr. Verheider and folks in this group of workers to have a job. But I just want to, for the record, to write to say, you know, we passed out of this legislature 2 years a funding solution that would have captured more taxes, that would have, in my opinion, more adequately funded the gentleman who's here from the school district, that maybe they wouldn't have had to go out and contract out, and they could have afforded to keep these workers cleaning their buildings. You know, so I really have a problem. And then there were people that voted against that, and then went out and campaigned against that. And so when we talk about the legislature cut this then that, I want everyone in here to know that I wasn't the one that voted to cut that, because it's important that we keep the record straight here. And as far as prevailing wage goes, that's been around for decades. I'm a personal beneficiary of it. We cannot, this economy, unless we have living wages, will cease. People buy these cars and these homes and purchase services because they can afford to. That includes what's called flexible benefits, health care, dental, vision, all the good things that we want everyone to have. So I just want everyone to know where I'm coming from and my consistent voting record and my consistent support for the services that were alluded to here today. And I think some inconsistent statements that have been made in this room. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, if I can follow up on that.
Yeah, and ask Tootie if we could. We are in our.
I'll just make one statement to that. Oh. He said Davis-Bacon has been around for years and provides jobs. The products of disability law also has been around for years and provides jobs. So I think maybe Representative Schaffler and I, on both the protection of jobs, have very much in common and very much at stake at this. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Brown, members of the committee.
Sandra, we have yours.
I'm going to be very, very short. I'm very hungry, and I'm sure you are too, and appreciate your patience.
Just for the record, Sandra Bishop representing the Fair Competition Alliance. Although the FCA had no hand in sponsoring the legislation, we are in support of House Bill 3271. And I'm going to confine, and there's a written statement on that. I'm going to confine my remarks to House Bill, support for House Bill 3281. As you know, the FCA is the nonprofit group that has both business and labor members. We have been researching this issue since 1996, and we're basically a research institute, so we formed officially in 1998, and it's a very unusual trade association in that it has one single issue, and that is to try to get fairness back into the contracting system. There's been, we've worked diligently with the Department of Administrative Services officials to asking for proper implementation and oversight and enforcement of this law that was put through in 1977 that hasn't happened yet. I'm going to skip down to the two main provisions and the only thing that you really need to be looking at today. You're hearing all kinds of stories. You're getting all kinds of factors brought in, some of them relevant, some not relevant. This is an exemption to the Public Contracting Code of Oregon. This is not a social service program. There are two main provisions in the statute that should concern you. Number one, the definition of disabled individual, and I'll go over 3 points that are not in my written testimony. Number one, the definition comes from ORS 344.511. It's identical wording to the VOC rehab statute. So when someone reads you another definition, my second point is when someone reads you a definition out of an administrative rule, you should know, or we should all remember, you cannot change statute through administrative rule. And that is, in fact, what the Department of Administrative Services has attempted to do through part of their 27 pages of rules on this law. Unfortunately, that's the advice that they're getting from the Attorney General's office. But that is not, the rule definition is not the definition that the 1977 legislature used to put into this statute. The only difference is that they dropped the word severely. But if you read those two definitions, ORS 344.511 and 279.835 subsection 3, they are identical. So the disability, this is not about disability alone. It's that the person is disabled so that the disability is such that they are unable to participate fully in competitive employment. You don't need to change the definition. You don't need to reinvent the wheel. You don't need to save the world. All you have to do is give clear direction to DAS to actually implement and have oversight over the existing definition. Yeah, that was my third point. And then if you look at the policy statement in this bill, and remember, it's not a social service program, it's an exemption to competitive bidding in the public contracting code. This is at 279.840. The policy statement is absolutely explicit that this is for the products and services from sheltered workshops and activity centers. I have handed in as part of my testimony, and Tina handed in as part of hers, the QRF applications from DePaul Industry, were just given to you right now. There's a list on the third page of contracts for unarmed security. Use your own judgment. Look at those contracts and tell me, or anyone else in this room, that those contracts are sheltered workshop and activity center products and services. Because that's what the law says. So it's not about changing the law, it's just enforcing it. And then if you look at Portland Habilitation, there, the other document is the PHC, or Portland Habilitation Center, QRF application, and it lists all of their contracts. Portland Habilitation Center has contracts of $29,658,552.52. And one contract alone for the Portland Public Schools is a $10.4 million contract. If these individuals are in a union job under a union contract, they are not the people that the 77 legislature intended to cover in sheltered workshops and activity centers, unless you want to declare all job sites in Oregon, sheltered workshops and activity centers, you really need to do something. So at this point, we're simply asking that you hold the school districts and the community colleges harmless. There is nothing in 3281 that will take jobs away from anyone. It simply applies to future contracts, and it's a step in the right direction. So I really ask you to keep in mind what the frame is. It's a public contracting exemption, nothing more. So thank you very much, sir.
Thank you, Sam. Thank you very much. And Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just going to make one brief comment, and very brief. I really feel strongly that all people should be able to have some employment, and really hope we can work to that end. And I just have to say that I don't feel that everybody deserves wage standards, and I don't feel wage standards are subsidies. When people work, they should be able to make a living. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. And with that, I'm going to bring the hearing to a close, and I'll apologize to those that didn't get the opportunity to testify today, and thank those that did testify. The Chair greatly appreciates it. Thank you. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3271 and 3281. And with that, we are adjourned.